Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 447th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is a singer, songwriter, and actress who has been working professionally since the age of seven, first shooting to prominence as the star of the Disney Channel sitcom Wizards of Waverly Place, which ran from 2007 through 2012, and the frontwoman of the band Selena Gomez and The Scene, which was active from 2008 through 2012. By her teens, she had become one of the world's biggest celebrities, the first person to accumulate 100 million followers on Instagram, where she now has 270 million, thanks to a solo recording career which was skyrocketing, and an on-again, off-again relationship with another equally famous young music artist. Now in her 20s, she has increasingly done work in both of her professions, which has earned her the sort of praise and respect she always craved. She has to her name three solo albums, all of which reached number one on the Billboard 200, and eight singles which broke into the top 10 of the Billboard Hot 100, including one which hit number one, 2020's Lose You to Love Me. She has worked with top-tier filmmakers ranging from Harmony Korine to Jim Jarmusch to Woody Allen, and she now finds herself in serious contention for a Best Actress in a Comedy Series Emmy nomination for her work on the first season of a Hulu comedy series on which she stars opposite Steve Martin and Martin Short, Only Murders in the Building. One of Time's 100 Most Influential People in the World in 2020, and someone described by Rolling Stone in 2021 as, quote, one of the most influential pop culture icons of our time, close quote, Selena Gomez. Over the course of our conversation, the 29-year-old and I discussed how a girl from Texas wound up in show business in the first place, and what her experience of child stardom was like, how she sought to rebrand herself after her years on the Disney Channel, and the ways in which those efforts did and did not take, why, as she began to experience turmoil in her personal life involving physical and mental health problems and romantic turbulence, she decided to get more personal with her music, and how doing so helped her, what it has been like sharing the screen with two legends of comedy on a TV show centered on one of her great fascinations, true crime, plus much more. And so, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Selena, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Great to have you. And on this podcast, we always begin truly at the beginning. If you could share with our listeners, where were you born and raised and what did your folks do for a living?
Sure. I'm Selena, and I was born in Grand Prairie, Texas. My mom worked several jobs. She had me when she was 16, so technically she was finishing high school and also working. My dad was a DJ. I don't know it was a promising career for him, but he definitely enjoyed music, and I feel like that's where some of my music, you know, my music comes from.
Yeah. And he, I gather they were both, were they both 16? That's a young love, right?
Yeah. But you know, you don't know someone. Right, so right. I think they are so much better without each other.
Well, so I guess, you were quite young when they went their separate ways. I know you grew up, I think, largely with your mom. And but just so people understand, because this is kind of influenced your music, I think, is it correct? Your dad's Hispanic and your mom is not, but sort of the influence of both is present in your music.
Definitely. My mom was an old soul, so she listened to a lot like the Rat Pack and listened to just great, like from the Beatles, Stones to Janis Joplin. Like, I just grew up listening to that kind of music, which I think has inspired me in a way of the lyrics. I just love how honest and real music is. And then I think my dad's side, especially with Spanish music, I really felt like it was a way of connecting with my roots that way. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually currently in Spanish lessons right now for fun.
Wow.
And really excited about kind of doing that because it's been a while and it's like, all right, it's about damn time I learned Spanish.
Well, I mean, we'll definitely note in a little bit that you made a big impression with some Spanish speaking music not that long ago. But I guess let's note that you're sort of being between two cultures is not, it's sort of a consistent with your, who you're named after, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of, there is this feeling. I was named after Selena Quintanilla, who is the Tejano singer, and it is pretty interesting, the similarities, meaning she spoke broken, you know, Spanish. She was born in Texas, and but she, you know, had a whole music career in Spanish, and she learned it along the way, which I think I'm doing as well. So yeah, it's pretty surreal. I think the surrealist moment, if that's a word, but sure, would have to be like meeting her family.
Oh, wow.
That was really an interesting, special moment. I was performing at the Houston Rodeo, which I believe was one of her last shows, and I invited her family. And it was just the coolest feeling, and we did a little tribute to her, so it was awesome.
That's awesome. Well, I guess to go back before you were doing public performances like that, can we always try to like pinpoint the moment where somebody caught the bug, or the bug became apparent in the creative, you know, creative bug for our guests. And I guess it seems like, from what I've been able to gather prepping for this, that maybe to some degree that was also from your mom just growing up watching her.
Yeah. So my mom was a theater actress, and she never did television or anything like that. I think she really loved the theater, and I loved watching her. I would go to her rehearsals and I would watch her plays. And of course, I admired my mom and adore her and look up to her. But I remember being this little demanding girl being like, I want to be on TV. I want to be like Lizzie McGuire. I remember wanting to be on TV, and I don't know why, but that was just something I wanted to do. So I think she is a huge inspiration. But mind you, my mom also is the kind of person that's like, if you're done with this business, like, be done. It's not worth your like well-being. So she's like really good. She's got a good outlook on it.
Well, I found a quote of hers from a while back where she was saying about you, you know, when did she first notice that you had sort of this creative chip? Quote, she was 6 or 7. I thought I wanted to be an actor. She went to one of my rehearsals with me and sat through the whole thing, not moving. On the way home, she was quiet. And then she goes, you know, Mom, that might be funnier if you did it this way. And I thought, yeah, oh no, she's going to be an actor, close quote. So I don't know if that's something you remember, but that's...
Yes, I do remember that. I thought I was so cool. I thought I was so included, and I thought I contributed, but I was such a little shit just running around, just being like, I can perform for everyone.
Well, so you expressed to her this desire to be on TV, but I mean, how does a little kid who's growing up in Texas actually have that happen? What was, I guess it was sort of just geographical freak thing with Barney, right?
Yeah, it really was. My family and I definitely didn't have the means to go to California to pursue anything, or New York, which are the, you know, hubs, I guess. And we couldn't really do that. And Barney, my mom found online when I told her I wanted to do it, I wouldn't let this dream go. I wanted to keep doing it. And so she looked up online and she saw an open call, and it was an audition. I didn't have an agent or anything. And it just said, auditions for Barney. And I, you know, I was 7. Barney probably wasn't as cool, but I just remember being so excited for my first audition. And then I sat in line with 1,400 kids. Oh. And it was really hot outside. And my mom kept asking me, do you want to go home? Do you want to go home? And I just, something in me was like, no, I don't. I want to stay till the end. I want to stay. And sure enough, I out of all those kids, they picked 7, and I happened to be one of them.
And was that the same casting call where I believe at some point you were auditioning at the same time with, and were basically cast at the same time as Demi Lovato?
Correct. So the funny, the wildest part of that story is that she actually was the girl standing in front of me. I remember she had a red bow on. I'll never forget it. And I remember thinking, wow, she's so pretty. She probably comes from like a really nice house. Like, you know, I didn't have a lot growing up, but just because she had a really pretty bow and like a nice outfit, I just thought the world of her. And we both ended up, after we got the part, we didn't know if the other one did. And we just had this like mini reunion when we saw each other when we got the part. And it was really fun. So that's what's wild, is that she was actually in front of
Unbelievable.
Me.
Well, and so this is like, I guess, between 2002 and 2004, you are on 13 episodes of that. I mean, it's easy to for somebody to be like, oh, it's Barney. How much could you have learned? But I mean, I think probably that was your introduction to just basics of acting, right? In front of the camera and how to, like, it was probably pretty valuable.
Oh, 1,000%. And, you know, when people even say the whole Disney chapter of my life, you know, oh, do you regret it? Or no, it was hard to kind of move away from it, but it wasn't. It really did train me. I mean, at 7 years old, I was learning. I was in the studio singing songs. I was in rehearsals for dancing. I had to learn how to open up towards cameras, make sure I knew where to step and stay. And I think that really, it's kind of like a pony pony race. It's just really interesting. But I had a blast. I mean, we had so much fun and it was my little escape. It was my escape from, you know, reality.
Yeah. So can you connect the dots? Like I said, I see Barney's 2002 to 2004, Wizards of Waverly Place for Disney Channel's 2007 to 2012. In between there, I know there were a number of other things going on, I guess, with that kind of put you on the radar of Disney Channel. And there I've seen like pilots of things that didn't happen or appearances on other shows that were not centered on you. But do you know yourself sort of what the most important steps were to make them say, hey, let's give this young lady a show of her own?
I will give full credit to Gary Marsh and Judy Taylor. He was the president at the time and she was the lead casting, and she was unbelievably supportive. And for some reason, those two people out of like a whole room full of suits really believed in me. And so they didn't know what to do with me. So that's when they decided to put me on a few guest shows, and I was able to do Hannah Montana and I did Sweet Life of Zack and Cody. But then I did a pilot that was for the show, based on Lizzie McGuire. Then I did another pilot based on Sweet Life of Zack and Cody. Then I did another pilot and that was called Wizards of Waverly Place. So that's how I ended up there. But it was a few years of them actually being so supportive and wanting me to have a home there. But, you know, I tried to do other things. I did commercials and stuff too.
Mm-hmm. And just to give people the kind of chronology of when you actually pick your life up from Texas and move to LA, I guess you shoot the Wizards of Waverly pilot at like 13, is that right?
Yeah.
And then they go with it and probably when you're about 14. And so
Correct. What's
that decision like in your family about, all right, we've got this opportunity now, but how is it going to affect our lives, where we are, what we do? Like, how did that go?
Yeah. Well, it was actually hard because my parents aren't together. Mm-hmm. So my dad stayed in Texas and technically I was underage. So it was both sides. Honestly, I couldn't have been luckier because my dad was devastated and was really, he had a job and he wasn't going to be able to do a lot. But I remember him just saying, this is something you want to do and I want you to do that. And my mom has always wanted me to believe bigger than where we're from because, you know, it's small where I'm from and you don't see anything. And so I really give them credit for choosing me over their own happiness. And then, and essentially I think that brought them happiness once I was working and doing what I love. So
now, was this one of these things where I've, you know, spoken with a lot of people who, when they first moved to LA, it's not, we don't know how long this is going to last, so we're going to keep kind of one foot in, one foot out, like Oakwood Apartments situation.
Totally.
It was like that for you guys?
Oh, no Oakwoods, no. So me and my mom were completely, we were a little bit oblivious. And in Texas, when you say downtown Dallas, it's like, oh, that's a nice area. So when we were thinking of moving to LA, we're like, downtown LA, that would be perfect because that's probably the safest. It's cleaned up a little bit now and it's kind of cool. But about over 10 years ago, we pulled up to move into the apartment complex and there was ambulances there. And it was, we didn't know what happened. Obviously, we hope it's okay. But I just remember being like, Mom, where are we living? I mean, not far off from where we're from. Don't get me wrong. It wasn't uncomfortable, but we actually did it the opposite way. We stayed there for a year hoping that the show would get picked up and eventually we moved to a better area.
Oh, my goodness. Well, so your time on that show, just if anybody needs a reminder or is unfamiliar, you're playing this teenage girl with magical powers. This is like 4 seasons. Overlappingly, I guess, is when you're starting to really get into music more with your band initially, Selena Gomez in the scene. And I mean, if people need a reference point, I guess the one that, I mean, I was a little outside of the demographic, but even I was aware of, you know, the songs like Love You Like a Love Song and some of the stuff you guys were doing. As your profile's exploding with both the acting and the singing, do you remember that time when you look back as being fun, stressful, something else? Like, how do you remember when it was all getting going?
I remember the first time I went to set and I got photographed on set through these gates. And I remember feeling like kind of a little grossed out. And that's when I think it started changing. And I don't know if it was necessarily a fun switch for me. I think once that started happening, I felt a little bit constricted. And I think that's when I lost a little bit of my being a kid, missing on being a kid because, you know, later in life, I realized I missed out on a lot and I definitely, you know, processed things differently than I do now. And so it is a little weird and there's growing pains in the midst of it. But I genuinely felt like overall it's really been a gift to see all these things come together. But there's not one day that goes by where I'm like, I'm set, like it's fine. I'm grateful for where I am, but I think and I believe that I've barely touched the surface of what I'm able to do. That's how much I believe in myself.
Yeah.
And I hope one day, you know, I'll be having a conversation with you again years from now or something, and we'll be talking about something exciting. But, you know, I just want to be able to be useful while I'm here, you know?
Totally. And I mean, I know that I began to kind of see the wider potential of what you could do, what you wanted to do when it seems like there was sort of a decision. I don't know if it was a plan or maybe it wasn't a decision, but just that around 2012, I think, is when Wizards ends, your band kind of ends, and then your solo career starts off really with Come and Get It, this single that goes to number 6 on the Billboard Hot 100. This is your part of your debut album, which debuts at number 1. But then there's also in that exact same period, I think, is when you were signing up to do Spring Breakers, which was not like anything else. You wouldn't have gone over great at the Disney Channel. So I guess can you just explain, was in that moment where one chapter is clearly coming to an end, was that point for you kind of exciting because now you can kind of maybe get into things that you couldn't have before? Or is it daunting? Because I guess it's sort of like when I've interviewed old time, you know, golden age Hollywood actors that were part of the studio system where you worked for a specific studio, similar to the way you were working with Disney Channel. I mean, a lot of people assume, oh, it's great to be totally free. But on the other hand, they didn't have to think about certain other things that they did when they were out from under there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I remember someone asked me when I was doing Spring Breakers and in an interview, they were like, you know, you're a role model. What do you think people are going to say when they see this? And I said to them, I said, this is, I think I said something along the lines, it was so long ago, but I said something along the lines of, this project is meant for me and my audience, from what you're telling me, isn't actually legally allowed to. I tried to get away with like saying they're not even legally supposed to. I was like, what they do on their own time is not up to me. I said, I'm just playing a character, but it was really funny. I didn't think about it too much. What I loved was, it was actually my mom's idea and she always gets mad at me. She's like, don't tell people that. But it was interesting because she showed me a few of his films, which obviously were very wild and weird and cool. And I loved them. I was like, this would be so different than anything that I've done. And I need something visceral. Like, I want to work with a David Fincher or a David O. Russell, like, who will push me to the edge to like go and fight for something. Like, that's the kind of acting that I crave to do more than anything. And I think that's me taking steps by not taking necessarily the lead part in a movie. Maybe it's just a smaller part that has to do with a greater support system that I'm working with people I can learn from. I completely forgot your question.
No, it's a good answer. I mean, we're just talking about how there is sort of this marker, it feels like, in a lot of ways with both music and acting, of 2012, one chapter ends, another begins. But I mean, as to what you're talking about with, even if it's in a small way, being a part of bigger kind of projects that are different. I mean, I know this was more a cameo even than a part, but something like The Big Short, I'm sure you're there because it's cool people to be working with, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what I dream to be around. You know, my best friend always says, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. And so I always constantly just want to be, you know, challenged. And this is what I love to do. With what I do with my platform is very different than my passion for acting and singing.
Well, and it's interesting that I don't even know how many people are aware of the fact that from a very early age, right around the time we're talking about, you're also getting into producing stuff that you're not even necessarily going to be a part of, and stuff that, not like a vanity project or just some people that want a production company to say they have a production company, but like, people may not know that 13 Reasons Why is because you and your mom decided to pursue that.
Definitely. I mean, when I decided to start producing projects, it actually started with 13 Reasons Why, because when we found the book was years prior to it even being shot. I was originally going to play the lead. Mm-hmm. And so we were excited. We had everything going and set, but then the years kept going by and I got older, and I also felt like I loved the book so much and I loved Jay, the author, and I just wanted it to be good. So I actually did want to be like, you know what, I just want to be there to support it, but I really want this to be good because it's important. And it just didn't make sense for me. So it was perfect. And I think that's when it started the bug, where I was like, wait, I can put my name on things that I can help create, that I could help, you know, input some sort of my vision into something and it be respected, was really empowering for me as a woman. I just thought that was really cool to be in involved with the whole process. It was really fun. So ever since then, I've tried to do projects that are different, that are, you know, from living undocumented to, you know, doing something like a 13 or doing other things that have to do with maybe a passion for crime or something. Right. You know, we're working on something like that. So it's just things that I care about.
Well, and it's interesting also because, I don't know, I'm looking at the chronology, 13 Reasons Why I think hit Netflix in 2017. You have been very open but about sort of, you know, just different depression and mental illness and things that a lot of people go through, but for whatever reason have been stigmatized for a long time. But I don't even know, was that even a factor in you being interested in 13 Reasons Why, or was that not yet even clear that that was a...
Yeah. 1,000% it was a part of what I really cared about. My mom has been very open too. She has dealt with a lot of, you know, mental health struggles, and so have I. So it's just kind of something that's been talked about in my family. And I really appreciate that because I get how I've seen how difficult it is for people to accept the words or the diagnoses of whatever it is they may be walking through. So I understand. But once I found out a little bit more about myself and figured out what would help me and what would allow me to be okay with my feelings, even though they're still there. So yes, immediately from the bat, I wanted it to be important. And the message, you know, was a little controversial. A lot of people had a lot to say about it. And I had parents coming up to me thanking me. And I also had parents coming up to me, you know, saying that they didn't like it. And it was, I welcomed both perspectives because I understood. But at the same time, I was very proud of the fact that we were starting a conversation, because that's something that unfortunately is very real and happens.
Yeah. Now, is it easier or harder? Maybe that's not even the way to look at it. Like, is it cathartic or not when you are personally connected to whatever form of art you're putting out? Because, I mean, it seems like, I could be wrong, but when you were making music, the first few albums as part of a band, I don't think those songs were especially personal to you. It's not my sense. But then it seems like there's a moment, and again, I could be wrong about the timing, but I mean, what it seems to come back to is around 2014, you have this part of the compilation album. People will remember that you were doing the song "The Heart Wants What It Wants," which you did a very emotional performance that in 2014 at the AMAs. A lot of people felt like, oh, this is the first time she's actually talking about stuff that's matters to her, that's about her. Followed very soon after by, I think, your first album that wasn't for Disney, full album Revival, which was, again, dealing with maybe more, perhaps more personal stuff than you'd done before. How did you get to the point where you were willing to do that?
Well, Disney is a machine. I mean, I will say they are really well-oiled machine. And they, you know, they had the singing aspect, the pop star aspect. They liked that. And I understood that and I enjoyed it. However, I can't write music other than, oh, I may have a crush on someone. I hadn't lived life. Like, there wasn't much that I could really say, at least for me. I was, you know, I was happy to sing, like, you know, who says you're not perfect, like all those fun things, because I felt like that was a way to communicate with my crowd at that time. And then once music kind of just became what it became for me, and then I signed with John Janik at Interscope, my whole life changed, because it was the first time that they were like, you know, this is your project. Take as much time as you need and you can do it. But I will agree with you. The Heart Wants What It Wants was the first time that I did ever say anything. And it was because I was fed up with everything else around me telling me all these things and the press just taking hold of whatever they wanted to. And it was me saying, hey, this is just, I'm just being honest with you for a second. Like, this is really hard and I know I should do X, Y, and Z, but I can't help it. And that's just the state that I was in, which ultimately then led me to Lose You to Love Me, which is my favorite song I've ever done.
Absolutely. And definitely want to come back to that in a moment. But just to, again, if people are trying to, sometimes it's easier to go along with the chronology if we're talking, referencing a single or whatever. No. So I just want to say with Revival, this is 2015 and this is Good For You. This is Same Old Love, which I couldn't stop playing that one myself. I love that. I'm so sick of that same old love. That shit, it tears me up. I'm so sick of that same old love. My body's had enough. Oh, that same old love. Oh, that same old love. And then again, it's interesting because there's 5 years between that album and the next one, Rare, but a lot of getting into, I think for the first time, sort of collaborations in the interim with different singles, right? We Don't Talk Anymore, It Ain't Me, Talkie Talkie, like all of that is between the two albums. But you've said that maybe the reason there was such a period between the two albums was that's when a lot of shit was going on in your life in every respect, right?
Yeah, no, it was crazy in a very, I think, essential. It was necessary for me to walk through those things. I had a lot of soul searching to do. And I mean, I don't have life figured out. But I do know that during that time, I was learning so much about myself. I was, obviously going through a really tough breakup. And then I just was left with the question of like, well, my career and where am I going to go and what's going to happen? And it just was all of these different things I was feeling. And then my medical stuff kind of kicked in. So I was dealing with my lupus and I was dealing with some kidney problems. So it was really hard, but being on the other side of it, I have to be honest, it's actually been really good for me. It allowed me to develop such a character where I don't tolerate any sort of nonsense or respect in any way. And I think I'm really proud of how I've come out of it.
And it's interesting. It must feel good to know that in each of these, since you began doing solo work, I mean, each one of these are at very different points in your maturation, right? But each one of them, there's clearly a pretty loyal audience or a growing audience. Different. Each one of these is number one on the Billboard 200 when it starts. That's a pretty incredible thing, and it of course leads to with Rare what you were just talking about, which I guess puts the button on some of the more dramatic stuff that you've just kind of recapped with Lose You to Love Me, which not only number one single, your first number one single on the Billboard Hot 100, but the first song ever to be number one simultaneously on the Billboard Hot 100, Apple Music, Spotify, YouTube, iTunes, and Rolling Stone charts. That's an incredible thing. And I guess I just wonder, to have that kind of a response to something that is so personal, so good, as you say, like for you, I know you're very proud of it, but I mean, objectively, critics, whoever else, for whatever they're worth, there's sort of a consensus that this was the best art up to that point.
Yeah. And I fully would agree with that statement. I think that, and it's wild because we wrote the song in less than an hour.
Oh my God.
And it was an idea that was just me, Julia Michaels, and Justin Tranter. And we were just us three in the studio, and it just kind of came out. Like, it was just, it just was automatically happening. And Julia is incredible at melodies, and all she kept hearing was the love, love, yeah, the love, love. And it was just so like haunting. But I did not expect it to do all of that that you just said, which is wonderful. I knew that it was going to leave some sort of impression because it was me kind of saying my goodbye. And I was really happy about it, but I was also nervous. And it went really well. Obviously, I'm so grateful. But to be honest, I think people who weren't necessarily even fans of me, I think it was more important that the song had a message. And that's what made me most proud, is that people were coming up to me at restaurants that were in their 40s and they were saying, I was going through a divorce and this song has like, and it just like, my mind was blown away. Like the stories and the vulnerability people were willing to give up when they met me or saw me after that period. It was really cool. It was a really cool way to kind of move on.
Now, one of the things I was wondering is you've always had these parallel things of singing and acting. Do they fuel each other? Like when you're singing, are you also in a way acting, for instance?
I think I'm most passionate about acting, which is funny when I say, because sometimes people are like, well, you've done a lot of music, though. And I think my thing goes back to what I was saying is that yes, I'm so grateful. I get offered parts about, you know, the tomboy turned into princess like crazy, you know, like I'm ready to play that part over and over and over again. And it's just not necessarily for me, but it is my heart and soul is when I am on set with people, I feel so right. And music, when I'm in the studio, I feel the same way. When I expose my music, I tend to get a little reclusive and I get overwhelmed because it's all me. It's all me. It's just my stuff out there. And so right now, for example, how I balance it out is I finished season two. I did my cooking show. Now I'm going to be in the studio until season three. So basically, we're going to just be working on new music and like I said, I couldn't do one or the other. Like, I actually love
both. I was going to say, it must be kind of like a palate cleanser to go from one to the other versus just there are some people who only have one. And I guess that could, I don't know if getting old would be the right way of phrasing it. But I could see that, you know, burning out a little easier.
Yeah, no, my therapist is like, girl, are you ever going to find a man? I'm like, I don't know.
Well,
I suppose I do feel like right now in my life, I am just so open and I love what I do. And if I want to take a day off or 2 days or a weekend off, I can. But I just am in a really good space right now and I'm enjoying
it. That's so great to hear. And I mean, I guess the treat for a portion of your audience, it was really in Revelacion, if I'm pronouncing it, I hope I didn't butcher it. But I mean, this was, I guess, your kind of pandemic baby in a way, along with Only Murders. But this was, I think, before Only Murders. And for 10 years, I know there were tweets, there were things saying like, I want to do this. This is a goal. It's sort of like the vision board out for the whole world, basically. But then it actually happened, your first Spanish language music. And again, the fact that it went over so well, not just sales or whatever, but you get a Grammy nomination for the first time for this kind of music in Spanish language must just be kind of, I would think, a confidence booster.
Oh, for sure. First off, I was like, thank goodness people understood what I was saying. That was really difficult to make sure I was doing that right. But it was actually more rewarding to be nominated for that than any of my English speaking albums, because I think I put my heart and soul in that in a different way. It was me talking to my dad and talking to my cousin back home and just reminiscing and talk, because I used to be fluent. And when I started working, I lost that because it was basically just, English speaking parts and stuff. So I kind of lost it, but it meant more to me because this is something I really was meticulous on. And I know how critical people can be, because if you do not pronounce something right, it's just not really respectful. So I'm more proud of that being nominated than anything else, because I really worked hard on it and everyone else did. And Tiny, the producer, and my vocal coach, like my language, it was just such a cool experience.
And I don't think you have to even understand Spanish to appreciate the music, which unfortunately I don't fluently speak Spanish, but I mean, people get it.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the beautiful thing about music is I listen to French music, I'll listen to Italian music, or it just makes you feel some type of way. And it's really special.
So I guess this wasn't one of the questions I planned to ask, but it just occurs to me, would you ever be interested in acting in Spanish?
1,000%.
Yeah, because that would be pretty interesting.
1,000% do that. I would love to. I feel like because I told you earlier, I'm taking lessons. So in general, I would love to get more, I guess more versed, but also just get back to my roots, because that's where I was. I was there, and that is me, and it's in there. I just got to get it out. And so, yes, 1,000%. Let me know if you find a good one.
I will, for sure. But I also just want people to know, because you referenced the immigration program that you've been involved with as well. And when you talk about getting back to your roots, this is not like discussing a topic because it's like the hot button topic of the day. This is, again, very personal. You've spoken about how, I guess it's your paternal grandparents first came to this country, right? I mean,
yes. So dad's parents, I think it was in 1972 or something, or three, they came over in the back of a truck, and it was my grandmother and it was my aunt. Sorry, I should say my great aunt. And they came over, and it took them 18 years to get citizenship. But they, obviously they did it the right way. It just took so much time. And I couldn't imagine what it was like during the thick of it, because if it was difficult for them when they were just doing all the right things to stay, and obviously, thank God, they got their citizenship and they're okay. But it is very important to me. That is also a huge part of why I did that project, because I just knew my story, and that's just a few people away from me. It's not like it was decades.
Right.
It was
not ancient history. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so to set the scene for this exciting project that we're primarily here to talk about, Only Murders, I think people may find it interesting. I know I did when I was reading to prepare, what your experience was going after acting parts prior to this, because, you have said that it was in some ways, really kind of emotionally a beatdown that you go in, what you want to do, what you feel capable of doing. You've been acting for 20 years, but because I guess in a way you were so established in people's minds for as a certain type of performer or child performer, or maybe they only know about you from what they saw in line at the supermarket or whatever bullshit goes into these things.
Yeah.
I guess it was frustrating, right? You weren't getting a fair hearing in your view.
I felt like it was very difficult for people to take me seriously. And look, I'm not going to be one to just be like, poor me or woe is me, because I have slowly pushed through that and I'm really glad, but it was very frustrating. I mean, I felt like a joke, you know, like there were moments where I felt like I was just like, I don't have what it takes to do this. Like, never mind, like, or whatever. I would get so frustrated with myself. But I gotta be honest, after I did Only Murders, I'm not getting a lot of like demanding phone calls. So,
oh really?
I am so grateful, because everything that I've done, I've earned and I've worked really hard for, and I would never replace that for the world. If everything was handed to me, I guarantee you I would be a totally different person. And I've seen that happen in people, and that's so disheartening. And so if anything, it's like, okay, I'm getting there. So I have a really healthy relationship with my outlook on that, which I'm really happy, because you have no idea. Steve got really mad, but like, you have no idea when people are like, yeah, when you were on the show, I was like, whoa, that's going to be weird. I don't know about that. And Steve like will get super defensive of me, and it's really sweet. But yeah, I get frustrated when people say that. And if anything, it's just another challenge that eventually I'll get to beat.
Well, so for Only Murders, let's talk about how this did come together. And first, in case there's anybody who is still needing to catch up on the show, give them a little tease that you're playing Mabel, this young woman who lives in an old building in New York, where she bonds with these two older guys who are living alone. And they end up trying to get to the bottom of a murder in their building, which is, this was season one, went on in August of 2021. And I guess the thing that I found kind of amazing was that they originally were thinking about this as, all right, Steve Martin, Martin Short, and a third male. So how did that, as your understanding, how did that change?
So my understanding is that Steve said he wouldn't be in it unless Marty was in it.
Mm-hmm.
So we got Marty, and that was the beginning before I was involved. Then Steve met with John Hoffman and they spoke, and it was actually some of the producers' collective idea of having a female, but not only a female, someone completely generations off. And Steve said he loved the idea and thought it was really fun. And then the next part was them hoping I wasn't going to be like annoying. And that's honestly the truth. They didn't know. They tell people all the time. They're like, well, I guess we didn't really know what to expect, you know, someone coming in that's younger. But I couldn't have been luckier, because they called me and I talked to everyone for a while, and I just told them all my fascination behind like true crime. And it happened, and I can't picture the show with three men.
No, I saw that John had said that somebody, I guess, made the point like, quote, don't we want an alien in their world, meaning Marty and Steve's, and just somebody that I guess they're not going to easily relate to, and that person is not going to easily relate to. But for that reason, I have to ask, not to get too meta here, but like, for you showing up and being a part of this, how familiar were you with Steve and Marty and vice versa when you guys first kind of had this, match made?
So I think Steve and Marty knew of me. I don't know if they necessarily knew any of my work. And then this, not necessarily the same, because I watched all the classics with my mom growing up, but it had been a while and I had not seen nearly enough, because they both have done a lot. But Jiminy Click was one of my favorite characters. So I knew Marty from that. And then obviously Steve from multiple different things I watched growing up. And so I knew. And then once I started working with them, then I started watching like the Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and like started watching all the other little ones. And I'd come on set the next day and I'd be like asking him questions about the movie. And he would just get a kick out of it because it's so fun to see what they've done. They are the original gangsters. Yeah.
Well, speaking of which, I believe that, you know, you're saying that you were gleaning some wisdom from them while you guys are working. I believe it was it went both directions. Speaking of original gangsta and also some other music.
There was that. Yes. Yeah, so I played them because they genuinely were interested in what's the fascination with today's music. And I said, well, let me just play you this one song by Cardi B and Meg Thee Stallion. And it was a very inappropriate song. And I'm sure people know the song.
Yes.
But it was hysterical. They were so confused. They weren't offended. They were just confused. They were like, so wait, do women like this? And I'm like, I'm like, yeah, I guess it's a thing, you know, it's a vibe. I don't know. And so they're hilarious because he'll be singing Joni Mitchell and then I'll just throw in some like rap music every now and then just to spice things up.
Right.
And that just certain lingo or just like questions like, you know, why is it that, you know, like, why is it that, you know, you can't go out and do so-and-so and like have a good time or something. And I'll have to explain my life to them and stuff. So it's really sweet. And then sometimes they tell me stories or Steve will start talking about art and I'm just like glazed over. Right. I'm just like, whoa.
Well, I think also people should keep in mind that the time in which you guys all came together is pretty like, you know, unique in that I believe it's like part of the pandemic in New York, which is sort of not New York at that time.
No.
And you know, here's two guys in their 70s and a young woman who's been through some health stuff that you've referred to, you know, referenced in this. And you guys are shooting with a global pandemic around you, but like not like it is now where I guess we, you know, you get your vaccine, you get your boost and you cross your fingers. But this was more of an uncertain time, right, for season one.
Yeah, I actually have no idea how we pulled it off other than the fact that Disney and Hulu were unbelievable with the system. The good and bad news about COVID is that no one was seeing each other. So we actually only spent time together. Thank God I find them very fascinating because I don't know what I would do. But I love them. And so I have a great time. So we actually just spent most of our time together and we would go back to our homes, but no restaurants were even open, nothing. So we kept it pretty clean. I think there was only one and it was in production. I don't think it was even on set. So we did a really good job and that's credit to the people who helped. But boy, was it annoying. Oh my gosh.
I heard you were saying like even like you have a kissing scene in the show that was complicated by COVID, right?
Yeah. So during the kissing scene, oh my goodness, every single take we would have to gargle with mouthwash and it would be the most intense one. And so imagine I'm doing, let's just say 7 to 8 takes and I have to sit there and they make you hold it in your mouth to swish it around really good. Then you can spit it out. My entire mouth was like so gross and like torn up. It was not sexy. I didn't want to kiss anyone ever again after that.
Well, now Mabel, I'm reading the way people have described her. And one of the descriptions was, quote, a character who conceals her vulnerability, close quote. And I wonder if maybe, not that you have to relate to every character you play, but I wonder if it might help to have a connection point. And because here's a way that somebody described you in a separate, totally unrelated article, quote, What's most unusual about her, what distinguishes her from other celebrities in her echelon, is the way she's grown softer rather than harder as she's gotten older. The confidence came first, then came the confidence to let it drop, close quote. So I don't know, maybe I'm overanalyzing this crap, but...
No, not at all. You're not overanalyzing, because that's how I got the part, was simply based on, like, my interests and my hobbies. And I think there was this element of loneliness that each character feels, which is why we connected with each other. I felt like being around two adult gentlemen, because that's what they are. They are very sweet and kind and hilarious and inappropriate sometimes, and it's the best. And it's like, just their humor. I just learned so much, and my expectation for a man, to be honest, or any human, is to be as decent as these two human beings are, because they have been doing this longer than I've been alive, and they are the kindest people. So I would say I relate to Mabel in the sense that I can be a little lonely sometimes, and I tend to, you know, have friends that are a bit older, and I, you know, love hanging out with, like, my mom. So I'm very much that kind of person. So I feel Mabel, but you know, that statement, whoever said that, is weirdly accurate, because I find that my heart has just been, you know, everything that happens in our world, it's like, why? There's so much that goes beyond just me doing my job and having a platform and needing to understand how to use that platform. It's just, I don't take any of my position lightly. I really don't. And I'm grateful, but it's, yeah, it can be a lot sometimes.
Yeah. Just want to note, you guys did some really ballsy stuff in season one, especially episode 7, I think, which is essentially dialogue free stuff like that. Is that exciting, intimidating, you know, for you?
So exciting. And, you know, I got to be honest, for season 2, we were doing a little bit more fun stuff that I'm excited for people to watch, because that episode was so well done. And I didn't know what to expect, because I remember shooting it, like, being like so confused, like, wait, what am I feeling right now? And it's so interesting, but it was really cool. And Joey, the actor, from his perspective, Theo is his character's name, it was so beautiful, and also sad. It was just really crazy. We got to step into his mind, and it was just really well done. I was so happy when I saw it. I was like, wow, that was good.
Totally.
That could have been bad.
Well, I was curious also, did you guys know at the beginning where this was going to end in terms of who did what or whatever? Like, sometimes these things are usually not shot in sequence, but I was curious if you knew what you're...
Yeah, well, we shoot in sequence, and boy, let me tell you, they did not tell us till like episode 8.
Oh my God.
What was happening.
So you don't even know if you did it.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I didn't know. I mean, I would ask and they would be like, no, it's not going to be you. But then I still didn't know.
Right.
I didn't know what it was going to be. But it was so great. And everyone on the crew was like, so we were all guessing and everyone was just having a good time.
Well, last minute or two, if we can, just some big picture stuff. What have you made of the reaction, not only to the show, but to your performance, which has been really, really... I don't know how much you read or follow this stuff, but it's been pretty great, to the extent that, you know, people are running numbers and stuff like now to see there's only been 2 Latina actresses who have ever been nominated for an Emmy in the category of comedy actress. Many people are, you know, to even just then be in that conversation, which you certainly are. I guess I wonder what that means to you.
Well, to be honest, it made me want to cry when you said that. That's really, really sweet. I don't like reading anything. All I do know is that people really did enjoy the show, and that's all I really wanted. But to get the appreciation and the respect and the love from all different types of people now is so nice. It just feels so good, especially with it having to do with something I love and I care about, and that's good. It's not me being happy I'm famous. It's me being happy that I did a good job.
Right, right. Number two of these last three, if my math is correct, you have a pretty big birthday coming up next month. So I have to ask, how do you feel about the birthday? And also, you know, a lot of people kind of on a milestone like that look back at things and just kind of sort of like what we've done, I think, during this hour. And I guess I wonder, though, for you, you know, as you hit that milestone, what do you make of it all? Can you kind of step outside of yourself and objectively just look at what a crazy ride it's been?
I can definitely take a step back and be very proud of the work I've done. However, I am happy getting older. I find that my toleration for any sort of discomfort, usually disrespect or whatever, even just unnecessary stuff, just I feel so glad that it's not, what is it? It's not like taking over me anymore. Like, my emotions are mine and I am allowed to feel them however I want to feel them. But I am having a party because I was like, you know what? All my friends back home are married with kids, so I'm just going to throw my own party and pretend.
Good, good, good. You should. And I guess you mentioned your friends back home. I don't know if you're referring to Texas or where, but it does beg the last question I wanted to ask you, which is, if you had never left Texas, what do you think your life would look like today?
I would have four kids for sure. Maybe not planned, maybe planned. Maybe both.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with, I think, the life I would have led. I just think that's kind of would have been my purpose. And that's really beautiful because my cousin has two gorgeous kids and she's like a therapist and helps children. Like, she's wonderful and she's so happy. I just know that that's not my path. And I'm really grateful I had my mom to really give me that opportunity to be what I want to be.
Well, also very glad that that happened because we get to see and hear all that you do. So thank you so much for taking the time to do this, and really appreciate it.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much for tuning into Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. Until next time, thanks for joining us.